This week on the Best of Flashpoints, we continue our drumbeat reporting from inside the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, with our special correspondent Andres Contreras. Also, award-winning investigative reporter Dar Jamail talks about the troop surge and GI resistance against militarism and U.S. occupations in Iraq and Afghanistan. Legendary journalist Robert Fisk talks about Obama's expanding wars, and Catherine Austin Fitz takes a look at the ongoing financial coup d'etat on Wall Street and in Washington, D.C. All this straight ahead on this week's Best of Flashpoints. Stay tuned.
First, we turn our attention back to Honduras and what's going on there. Negotiations organized by the OAS continued in Tegucigalpa today, and some progress is being reported, but the continual sticking point is the restoration of Manuel Zelaya, the duly constituted president to power. Meanwhile, the coup government continued its crackdown on alternative media, and repression continues across the country. Joining us from the Brazilian embassy, where the president is in Tegucigalpa, is Andres Thomas Canteras. He works with Democracy Now! En Español. He's been a good friend to Flashpoints and working closely with Pacifica Radio. Andres, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Dennis, it's great to be with you and Nora.
Well, it's good to have you with us again. I want to ask you about the negotiations, but first of all, am I correct in saying that the crackdowns have continued? I assume that you're still surrounded by security forces there in the embassy.
You know, Dennis, not only has it continued, it has intensified here around the embassy. I was talking with a friend just last night and saying, I guess we will never experience nighttime again here at the embassy. They've installed some incredible floodlights that totally keep the whole area lit all night long. They installed some platforms that are elevated accordion style with hydraulic lift. And there are two platforms where police stand on the platforms and observe what is happening inside the embassy compound. I saw one of the soldiers there with binoculars looking at a certain thing. I realized he was looking at the office where President Zelaya was, and the door at that the sliding door at that point was open, so he could see into the office. And he ran over and let the president know that, and they shut that door. This sort of close observation, this is part of the psychological warfare that is happening, because we are under observation constantly, and the lights are on now all night long, and it's just a way to keep instilling terror on us. But it really doesn't compare to the terror that the people of Honduras are feeling under this coup regime. The repression in the streets continues horrifically, quashing the protests that have been outside the Clarion Hotel, where the negotiations are taking place here in Tegucigalpa, and this is something that continues under the emergency decree that Mr. Micheletti signed, and he said just before the OAS arrived that decree suspending constitutional guarantees would be withdrawn, and so that appeared in the media around the world. We even reported it on Democracy Now!, but it was a lie. It never happened, because it was never published in the governmental gazette. And as long as it is not published in the gazette, it is not law. And so even today, now, we are living under the suspension of all of those constitutional guarantees. And of course, Radio Globo remains closed, as does Channel 36. And these are demands that the OAS made. The OAS demanded that the media be allowed reopen. They also said that the place around the embassy should be demilitarized, and that has not happened. This is an absolute violation of the spirit in which the negotiations should be taking place.
And in terms of the resistance, I know you're inside the embassy there, but does it seem to be growing despite the crackdown, or has it gotten to the point where it's too dangerous for many people to go out into the street?
Well, this is day 108 of the resistance to the coup, the nonviolent witness that the Hondurans have been doing in the streets, marching and cultural events and street theater. And it's just magical to see how they have responded so creatively to this repressive regime. And so, no, some people are definitely inspired by fear and they do not take to the streets. But the resistance has continued forward. They have remained persistent in their endeavor to keep pressure on this regime.
Let me ask you, coming back to that light 24 hours a day, that, I guess, was... are you there?
Yes.
Andres, okay. That was sort of after they used the sound to sort of deafen everybody. It seems like they are employing every kind of sort of mass torture that doesn't leave a bruise. In terms of what's going on at the embassy.
You're so right about that, and we've researched this a little bit. I never had heard about this before, but there are these things called DEWs. They're directional energy weapons. It's how you direct energy in a weapon fashion. And this is and what was done to us on September 22nd was using an acoustical weapon, the piercing, shrieking noise that we were victims of here. But also a few days later, they felt that in Pittsburgh at the G20 protests, and so now we're enduring the constant floodlights all night long, and there's a lot of suspicion that they have used microwave weapons against the embassy because of some of the symptoms that people have had, and some of the ways that that kind of weapon is deployed. So, these things also are all part of the psychological warfare against us here in the embassy, and it's a way to try to affect the spirit of President Zelaya, but he remains completely committed to trying to find a peace solution to this. He knows that the methods of pressure that are being used are definitely damaging, they are affecting people, but he himself is still committed to the dialogue, and that's what's been going on the past few days.
And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. We're going to turn our attention to another issue that relates to the Nobel Peace Prize, and that's expanding wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and who knows where else. But if anybody does know, it's Star Jamil. He has been on top of this story for years. We started speaking with him on the ground in Iraq, where he was doing incredible work, sort of the same kind of work that Andres is doing now in Honduras, and important work for the people. And, Dar, let me start off by reading just a little bit of an article that you wrote that came out today that relates to a press conference that took place today, and I want to come in that door if we could. And you write on Truth Out, attorneys and veterans groups are alarmed by recent reports that two U.S. Army soldiers imprisoned at Fort Lewis Regional Correctional Facility have been subjected to human rights abuses and violations of their constitutional rights. We're talking about Leo Church and Travis Bishop. Dar, welcome back to Flashpoints. It's always an honor to have you in with us.
Thanks, Dennis. Great to be with you again.
Okay, well, let's talk about this press conference today. Who called it, and be more specific about what the charges are?
Well, a little background first. These are two soldiers, Leo Church and Sergeant Travis Bishop, who were recently court-martialed at where they were stationed, which was Fort Hood, Texas, Killeen, Texas. I believe it's the largest base in the country and arguably the most heavily deployed base in the country. They were both court-martialed for different reasons and then sent up to the brig at Fort Lewis. And since their first 9 days there, they were held completely incommunicado, which of course violates the Sixth Amendment. They were completely denied access to their counsel. Their civilian attorney is a guy named James Branham. And then finally they've been allowed to see their counsel, but only with guards present, which continues to violate their Sixth Amendment. And then recently, James Branham told me that both soldiers were being sort of a little psychological warfare played against them, where in addition to their Sixth Amendment consistently being denied, they've been actually having the security at Fort Brigg has found it in their interest to basically do things with both these guys, like have female guards watching them when they take showers rather than male guards, and female guards watching them when they use the bathrooms rather than male guards. And so this sort of thing going on, and then also James Branham told me that, you know, given that his conversations with both of these soldiers are monitored, that specifically Sergeant Travis Bishop has said, look, there's more I need to talk to you about, but I can't because, you know, this is private information and I don't feel comfortable sharing it with you until we can do it privately. But of course, that's still not happening.
We're speaking with Dr. Mile. By the way, his most recent book, The Will to Resist: Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, it comes out on Haymarket Books. And want to let you know that that's an important book. If you're interested in following this growing GI resistance movement, you want to check that out either in the bookstores or the library or wherever, or in your local prison if you're stuck there. And there's going to be more debtors' prisons, I'm sure. But let's just step back a little bit. These two resistors are not alone. In fact, Aaron Watada, remind people who he is, and you actually sat in his court-martial.
I actually didn't sit in Aaron Watada's court-martial, but I was present at a speech he gave during the time. Let's go back to fall 2006. It was around that time that Aaron Watada became, at the time, the highest-ranking person in the military to refuse a combat deployment to Iraq, a lieutenant, a West Point grad, very articulate, intelligent person, and obviously posed a big threat to the military. Because he gave a speech that I got to see at the Veterans for Peace National Convention in Seattle of that year in August 2006. And Watada basically lined out a blueprint he said basically, look, if you're really serious about ending these wars, you have to basically get behind the soldiers and let them know that you have their back if they're going to stand up and resist. That means you're going to help take care of their families. We're talking real sacrifice. We're talking about this is the blueprint of if you want to have a modern day GI resistance movement, this would be a good way to go about it. So the military tried to throw the book at him. The judge blew the court-martial trial. They basically let Watada sit behind a desk up at Fort Lewis for a couple of years. And I believe it was two Fridays ago they released him. So Watada is now a free man. And, you know, that did get some attention. But I think the core of this story is this, you know, that many people believe, well, there's no real GI resistance. There's no future for people who are going to stand up and they're not going to win. Well, Lieutenant Watada, the highest person in the military to date to refuse a combat deployment, did not spend one day in jail nor one day in one of these illegal occupations.
But it was certainly an incredibly courageous action, how he acted, the dignity with which he acted, and how he expressed himself and his reasons. How can we understand if that resonated within the larger military, or how does something like that or these other guys, how does that resonate?
Well, there is a lot of resistance in the military today, and it's a complicated scene because on one hand, as we just saw today with the Pentagon announcing, hey, we had the biggest recruiting since we created an all-volunteer force in 1973. And that's true. And of course, you know, it doesn't take a genius to figure out why, because they're basically the only job on the block. So they're exceeding their recruitment goals. But that does not change the fact that those already in the military, we're seeing thousands of people a year going going absent without leave. It's between 4 and 12,000 a year, depending on any given year. Between 2006 and 2007, we saw a 42% increase in the Army of the number of people going absent without leave. We're seeing people leave like rats from a sinking ship, and it's primarily because of things like we talk about how the military is treating its own. We look at Leo Church. We look at Travis Bishop. We look at how are soldiers being treated when they come back home. You know, we have 1,000 veterans a month that are technically under the auspices of VA care are trying to kill themselves. We're looking at 18 soldiers a day in this country killing themselves. We're looking at record numbers of suicide rates in the Army in 2007, surpassed in 2008. That was also a record year of suicides in the Marines. And this year, we're on a record number of suicides again for the Army. So the military is in a state of breakdown. Morale is very, very low. And of course, this is on the heels of just learning that if you include total numbers of the first Obama surge, it wasn't 21,000 into Afghanistan, it's 34,000. And this is why we're talking about up to 60,000 more being deployed, which is just about going to double the number of soldiers there. So all of this together shows us we have a very, very fertile ground for GI resistance today.
Let's talk about the wars. Now, with this push for more troops. By the way, the Democrats, let's thank them because they're the ones that pushed this over the top. Dianne Feinstein, doesn't her husband have connections to the military? I suspect they're doing really well there in the fight, but I'm sure it's a blind trust for her, so she's not benefiting. But she came out four square for more troops and lots more troops. And the logic is, Doran, I want you to talk about this. Look how well the surge worked in Iraq. We can have the same success in Afghanistan. You want to talk about that logic?
Right. So, you know, there's still a large camp of people. And, you know, Dianne Feinstein would be a fine example, as would Nancy Pelosi, of these types of people who think that actually bought the rhetoric that the surge worked. When the reality, the reason why violence is lower in Iraq for U.S. troops, not for Iraqis per se, but for U.S. troops, had nothing to do with the surge. It had everything to do with buying off the resistance, where they went in there, and it started around April 2006. The RAND Corporation had a report that came out on this. If folks like Dianne Feinstein and Nancy Pelosi like to read military link think tank reports like the RAND Corporation, they would have known this, but obviously they don't read these reports. But the RAND Corporation report showed us very clearly that the U.S. basically started buying off corrupt tribal sheikhs to basically buy off the resistance. And that's the main reason violence went down. But then if we're going to apply that to Afghanistan, coupled with a massive surge of U.S. troops into that country, it's just not going to work. Neither of them are working. The U.S. today in Afghanistan controls about one-third of the country. The Taliban controls the other two-thirds. The U.S. basically can't move much during the day. They can't move at all during the night because the Taliban control the night. So, you know, when you put, we've seen this massive number of troops injected into the occupation. We've seen a corresponding massive increase in the number of Americans being killed there, and especially the number of civilians being killed, the war bleeding well over into Pakistan even more than it was before. And let's have a little historical perspective, right, Dennis? I know you know this, but, you know, Afghanistan, this is a place referred to as the place where empires go to die. So let's send 60,000 more troops there.
In Berkeley, I'm Dennis Bernstein. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, and we turn our attention back to what's going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, and around the region of war and more war, particularly watching what happened in Pakistan last week over the weekend with a bold takeover of central military headquarters and then a massive attempt by the military to free hostages, many people killed. Joining us to talk about these very crucial issues is Robert Fisk. Among other things, he is the author of The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. He is a correspondent, award-winning many awards for The Independent of London. Robert Fisk, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thank you, Dennis.
All right, let's start with the significance of that raid in Pakistan. Were you surprised, and what does it mean to you?
Well, I wasn't surprised because despite what the Pakistanis say, and despite what indeed your own government says, the Pakistani intelligence services are deeply involved with the Taliban. And If that is the case, which it is, it was not a difficult issue to get Taliban members inside the headquarters of the army. Remember, we're not just talking here about just a barracks or some kind of military installation. We're talking here about getting Pakistan's major Islamist enemies inside the headquarters of the army of the nation of Pakistan. This was not, I think, you know, significantly foregrounded, to use a Chomsky phrase, in the report. This was an attack and effectively the capture of Pakistani army headquarters. It was portrayed in the Western press, and by that I mean the American press, I guess, as being, an embarrassing a blow to the government and the army. They got inside the headquarters. They took over the army. You know, and we don't seem to realize this. Now, okay, sure, most of the militants, killers, aggressors, call them what you like, were killed. The top man appears to have got away. They always seem to do in that region, don't they? But, you know, I mean, hold on a second. There's a major problem here. Can you imagine if any other country's military headquarters were stormed and taken for 24 hours by their enemies? It would be a scandal on a massive international scale. But no, it was just another part of the war on terror being carried out in Pakistan. You know, for 24 hours, the army lost and they won it back again. And so we go on. This, remember, is a nuclear power. Pakistan has nuclear weapons. Quite extraordinary. I find more and more now that the reporting of events in the Middle East is becoming more lethal than the events themselves.
Hillary Clinton was quick to the microphone to reassure the world, and particularly U.S. Congress, that things were okay in Pakistan, because the U.S. Senate and Congress are getting ready to send a major aid package, $7.5 billion, to Pakistan. They say non-military aid, but...
You're very kind people, Dennis. You really are kind to people, aren't you?
I gave a little bit out of my own wallet. I'm sure you know that.
Yeah. Well, you poor taxpayers. Yeah. I mean, excuse me. I mean, really, the way you bandy money about it is just incredible. You know, I mean, you've been doing this to the Pakistani military now ever since 2001, as long as there are various leaders, and for most of the time it's been, you know, general dictator Pervez Musharraf, you're happy to keep handing this money out. Why do you do it? You know, what? Don't you realize that this country is spinning out of control? You know, I like Pakistan. I like going there. And not just because the Brits used to be there, of course, running it in this wonderful way when it was part of the Empire of India. But the problem in Pakistan, it is a totally corrupted country from the bootblack boy up to the president. And, you know, this idea that you can just keep throwing money at it and it's going to be okay, this is something left over from the Cold War. I mean, I noticed America used to do the same thing with Gaza. You know, just throw money at it. But the people of Gaza were not demanding, you know, new prenatal clinics and hospitals. They were demanding freedom and a Palestinian state and an end to occupation. It's like people call out for what they want, and we are deaf to them, and then we want to hand them dollars, which is lovely if you want dollars, especially if you're a corrupt politician in Pakistan or Gaza. But that doesn't solve the problem.
Well, let's just move the geography a little bit over to Afghanistan. Talk about...
I feared you might. Yes, it's even worse, isn't it?
It's even worse. Talk about that now. Obviously, everybody's admitting widespread patterns of corruption, unbelievably crazy situation there. Talk about Afghanistan and what is the relationship to Pakistan?
Well, look, I've been saying for a long time, and I'm not the only person, Tariq Ali has been saying the same thing, and that is that, you know, we've got to concentrate on issues of justice and injustice. And for Pakistan, the critical issue is not Afghanistan, it is Kashmir. Now, before 2001, there was a reasonable plan coming forward to the effect that there might be some kind of federal solution and demilitarization of Kashmir. Anyway, arrives Obama, and the first thing he does is he says to Richard Holbrooke, his envoy to Afghanistan and Pakistan, or AFPAC as we're supposed to now, you know, the new cliche, you don't deal with Kashmir. And the reason is quite simple, because America wants to stroke the fur of India as a balancing power to China. And the Pakistanis are very angry about this, whether they be the president, whether they be the army, whether they be the intelligence services. So in order to put pressure on America, Pakistan gives more support for the Taliban, who kill more American soldiers. Those soldiers are not dying for the freedom of Afghanistan. They're not dying for the corrupt president, Hamid Karzai, or for drug dealing by his warlords. They are dying because America will not deal fairly over the issue of Kashmir, a place they've never been to and in many cases wouldn't even know much about.
I need to get that, you. Go on. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to. Sorry. You're the opposite of the CNN who always want to change the subject. No, the issue is that we're either going to take a short-term view, we're fighting for democracy, which is rubbish, or we're going to see Afghanistan in a larger picture, which is it is primarily about Kashmir. American soldiers are dying in Afghanistan because America will not deal fairly and justly with Kashmir any more than it will, I'm sorry to say, over Palestine.
You know, we were planning to get Angana Chatterjee, who wrote a book, Violent Gods, about Kashmir. A very powerful book. We had a fundraiser, unfortunately.
Yeah, I read it.
He has to postpone it. But please talk a little bit about Kashmir, because you are right that people don't know a damn thing about the relationship there with Kashmir, with India. And anybody, obviously, you know, anybody who talks about Pakistan without talking about India isn't talking about the subject. So please.
Look, first of all, you have to understand that India and Pakistan both have nuclear weapons. This is the major confrontation of our age. Not Iran, with its pathetic, Hillary Clinton frightened facilities for nuclear production or rather, nuclear power for electricity, or maybe weapons, who knows. If I was a member of the community of the Muslim states, I'd probably want some nuclear weapons to stop America invading me. But I've said this before, and it's self-evident. The problem about Kashmir, as you know, and let's not get involved into where the frontier runs, is that this was the result, the direct result, of the British end of empire. Mountbatten and the British government gave a British civil servant six weeks, I think, rather than 6 months, to chop up India and Pakistan into separate states. Pakistan, of course, was part of the British Indian Empire. It was Indian as far as the British were concerned. And when they did so, they drew a horrifically unfair line right through the middle of the most magnificent, beautiful, colorful, mountainous area of Kashmir between the two states. And it has ever after, for reasons that, you know, you need a whole separate program to explain, been a center of tension and injustice and murder. Murder by the Indian Army. Murder, I'm afraid to say, by the Pakistani Army. And I'm afraid to say it of the Indians as well. Between radicals from both sides who demand that Kashmir must be Indian or Kashmir must be Pakistani. As I say, before 2001, there was the beginning of a federal framework relationship that might have brought some kind of peace to Kashmir, but it hasn't. You've got to remember that when Pervez Musharraf started a war in Kashmir against India, he used Islamists to do that as well as his own army. And many of those Islamists were trained in that war and prior to it, who are now being sent into Afghanistan. And they don't regard themselves as being foreign fighters. If they fought for Kashmir as a Muslim entity, then they'll fight for Afghanistan as a Muslim entity. And if they're Pakistani, as we would regard them, but they may regard themselves as Pashtuni, then, you know, they're just fighting for their war. They don't regard the front lines and the imperial rules of, you know, the British Empire as having any basis in their political life. And that is the problem. But we won't deal with this. We won't recall it. We won't talk about it. We won't show it on television. It's them versus us. It's bad, bearded, you know, dark-skinned, brown-eyed people against these wonderful Democrats, some of whom, of course, are also brown-eyed, but many of whom look like us. And there you go. Remember, I mean, the most racist element of this came in the Bosnian War. When I remember, and I was covering the Bosnian War, which was the most, you know, savage war I've ever covered, because the Europeans, I found, fight more savagely than anyone else on earth. The issue there, remember, from the Brits was always, we've got to help these people because they look like us, they're our people, i.e. they had like colored skin and blue eyes and were sort of, looked a bit like Anglo-Saxons or French or Germans. You know, this is, we're dealing with racism here in the Middle East now, unfortunately, in a very big way.
Is it safe to say that one of the key issues for the Pakistanis in the context of Afghanistan is that they want to maintain their sphere of influence and they don't want India coming near it? Is that in this mix?
Oh, I'm sure it is. Look, here you have India pouring billions of dollars into Afghan reconstruction. Never before has India poured this kind of money into a Muslim state. India is not Muslim. It's outbidding Pakistan in the assistance it gives. No wonder the Indian embassy has been targeted twice in the course of just over a year. No wonder. This is Pakistan attacking the Indians. You know, nobody in Kabul believed after the second attack in the last few days against the Indian embassy that this was some kind of, you know, accidental aggression. This was Pakistan saying India must leave hold of Afghanistan. We run Afghanistan. India wants Kashmir. It'll have to fight over it. Kashmir is the issue. And again, Kashmir is about the issues of justice or injustice or compromise. Same as Palestine.
NPR has reported on a series of stories in which they talk about the new successes that the American military is having in the heartland of Afghanistan, winning the hearts and minds. And they've, you know, they say they've even got Marines who have beards who are, you know, sort of a sign of wisdom to the local leaders. They see a Marine with a beard and he's the wisdom and the headman.
Yeah, this is great stuff, Dennis. This is lovely, and it would be lovely to believe it, frankly. But you know, every guerrilla war in the world is accompanied by stories like this, whether it be the British in Northern Ireland, where they were, you know, keeping the Catholics from the Protestant throats and vice versa, whether it be the French in Algeria, who were just trying to, you know, stamp out this small minority of violent terrorists, the FLN, who still run Algeria, whether it be the British fighting the Haganah, Jewish terrorists, quote-unquote, I don't use the word terrorists, in Palestine, or the Arab terrorists, quote-unquote, in Palestine. Over and over again, we hear the same story that, you know, it's only a question of wiping out these violent, evil, mindless people. And at the end of the day, their struggle is based, however mendaciously by them, on real injustices. And unless we deal with these injustices, whether they be in Palestine or southern Lebanon or Kashmir or Northern Ireland, we will not have peace.
We're speaking with Robert Fisk of the Independent of London. His book, his great book, The Great War for Civilization, The Conquest of the Middle East. It could hold back a big stadium door. I'm getting so old, I need to put it in a rolling cart. And
Dennis, stop. I have a friend in Cyprus, a former BBC journalist, who tells me that he uses all my books as doorstops. And I tell him that I was the first person that suggested these books should be used as doorstops. But he doesn't accept my copyright.
Well, I wanna let you know that Muriel Rukeyser, in her collected poems, has in the introduction that her book of collected poems could be easily used to hold back a big door, and I think you're in good company there. But I do want to say the door it holds back for me, Robert, and I say this with all sincerity, is the door that lets out a open flow of information that does not exist in this country in particular. So we appreciate that kind of work. And that's why I'm working you so hard.
You're beginning to sound like a pinko, Dennis. I have to say that.
You got me.
Sorry. I need friends, but not like you, you know?
You keep exposing me. Listen, I do want to... I have a couple more questions for you.
Mm,
and
sure.
Let's move it to Iraq. And you know that the line here is that we have to do the surge in Afghanistan so that we can have the effectiveness and the success that we had in Iraq.
Look, these are tales to frighten the school children, as Thomas More once said to Thomas Cromwell, not long before Thomas More had his head chopped off. First of all, we went to Afghanistan, did we not, to destroy the Taliban and capture Al-Qaeda. We clearly did not destroy the Taliban. We certainly didn't capture Al-Qaeda. Then we went to Iraq for all kinds of reasons. We were going to democratize the Middle East. We were going to end the weapons of mass destruction, capture them, you name it. That turned into folly. Now we want to go back and fight the first war all over again. I don't think Afghanistan is Vietnam, but I'm very struck by the fact that the right-wing neoconservatives in the United States are now saying that to describe Afghanistan as the graveyard of empires is a cliche. They're absolutely right. It is a cliche. But it's also true. If Obama is going to go down as a disastrous president, it will be because of his, in my view, incomprehensible desire to continue the war in Afghanistan. It cannot be won. There is no way it can win. It doesn't matter whether you have the McChrystal version or any other version of how to win the war. You won't win a war in Afghanistan. I was traveling over that country not long ago in an airliner en route to Kabul. I was actually over the sort of southern Kandahar bit, Helmand, Kandahar province and onwards. And I looked out the window of the Boeing airliner, and there were these extraordinary volcanic excrescences, you know, the mountains you could not climb except with a helicopter, and then he'd be shot down. And my next-door neighbor said, how can they ever win there? And I said, they can't. That's the whole point. You only have to fly over the country and look at it from the air to realize there is no victory in Afghanistan. And there is not. And it doesn't matter how you access it philologically, linguistically. Oh, well, you know, we're not trying to win. What we're trying to do is bring the power back to the people. We're trying to get the Afghans to govern themselves, look after themselves, produce their own security. You know, this sounds okay in Congress, but on the mountaintops, it's just garbage. I'm sorry, it's garbage. America has to leave, and all Western armies, I've said this before in your program, must leave the Muslim world. Give them, by all means, doctors, agronomists, economists, but no more soldiers. Please, no more soldiers.
Could it be that if Hamid Karzai, the U.S. guy there in Afghanistan,
democratically elected. Hold on, Dennis. He was democratic. Well,
Let me ask you that. This is the
Peter Carl Brace has been on your program recently, I hope.
Listen, this is the question.
Let me interrupt you. Peter Galbraith is probably right. And the Norwegian Mr. Kai is probably wrong. He's being too soft on Karzai. I mean, I'm not terribly keen on Mr. Galbraith for his quotations on the ethnic cleansing of Knin in Croatia, but nonetheless, he might be right on this. It was a grotesque election. And you know, we're going back to the old Vietnam days where we say we must have democracy, and if we don't have democracy, we're going to back the good guys.
Now, is it possible that with Karzai having the support from the drug lords and his brother, who's a major drug trafficker, could it be that he's not also engaged in the drug trade?
Mr. Karzai, I'm sure, could never be accepted to enter the United States to appear at the General Assembly to listen to Mr. Bush, as indeed he did, and I was there quite close to him, in 2002, September the 12th to be precise, if any such reputation ever accrued to him. But the truth of the matter is that Karzai is just another gangland warlord, and so is his brother, and so are his comrades in government. You know, if we'd been really keen to deal with the problem of Afghanistan, and I've had a lot of Afghans say this to me, men and women, we would have gone in there in 2001, fought man-to-man with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, and hoovered up every gun in Afghanistan. But we didn't. We paid the people with the guns to fight the guys we wouldn't shoot at because we didn't want to get killed. And that's what we have today.
Well, the new Nobel laureate in the White House says that
he's not a laureate; he's a winner.
He's a winner. The new winner.
Yeah, well, he got the Nobel Prize for public speaking, didn't he?
That's cynical, isn't it?
Sorry,
is that cynical or?
Definitely, yeah. Well, no, not cynical. He deserves the Nobel Prize for public speaking, but not for peace.
And he says that it's, as many have said before, that the battle is there with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, that the future of the United States depends on winning that battle.
We have an old English word, Dennis, called tosh. It means garbage, zabali in Arabic. You know, I'm sorry, if you deal with injustice, these groups will fade away like weeds that just decay in the sun. If you don't deal with injustice and you deal in drones and F-18s and laser-guided bombs, they will grow in power. It's as simple as that. Do we want to deal with justice or not? Mr. Obama, your president, said there must be a freeze to settlement building for Jews and Jews only on occupied Arab land. And the Prime Minister of Israel said no, and Obama has gone along with that and dropped it as a condition. There is no justice for the Palestinians. There is no justice for the people of Kashmir. I don't support anyone who says Israel can't exist. It is a nation state approved legally by the United Nations. It's there. But if there's no justice, there will not be peace. And it doesn't matter how much Barack Obama beats the drum of war and says, we got to win. This is, excuse me, please, this is, we go back again to Thomas More. These are tales to frighten school children. We need to deal directly with the problem. And this, your country, will not do. And for that reason, nor will mine, whether it's Mr. Brown, who leads the next administration in Britain, or Mr. Cameron. And this is the problem, and I go back to something I've said to you before, that government is not about good guys and bad guys. It is about power and the use of power.
You know, I believe your prime minister announced more troops today, I guess.
Don't keep calling him my, even though I do. I've never voted in an election for anyone in my life, but Mr. Brown does not represent me.
I feel like I'm in good company now.
Who did you vote for at the last election?
No,
I imagine you voted. Did you not?
No.
You didn't vote at all? Dennis,
I'm admitting now, before you and the rest of the world, the few 10 people who are listening, that I, like you, Mr. Fisk, have not spent a lot of time in the voting booth. I tend to vote with information.
Have you voted in the last election, Dennis? You slightly doubt the question. Did you vote?
No, I did not. And I guess, is there a way that you can find that out?
I have not the slightest idea. I'm not an intrusive journalist
check
like you, Americans.
Check out with the Patriot Act. I'm sure they have.
I'm sorry. Even the what the acronym stands for is truly childish, but or infantile. Anyway, carry on.
All right. Well, and of course, the successful war now is Iraq. What's going on there, and is it a successful war? Is that an example for Afghanistan?
Iraq remains an incendiary place of constant car bombs, of civil war, where the Kurds in the north are constantly at loggerheads with the central government, especially over the city of Mosul, and therefore, of course, we're talking about oil and the oil reserves beneath Mosul. I think that what America is trying to do, what Obama wants to do, is to creep like a fox out of Iraq and have long enough time, he can go off and fight in Afghanistan or whatever, but a long enough time afterwards before the war begins and the disintegration of Iraq begins to say, well, we left and everything was okay. It's not our fault. This is them. You have to talk to them about it. And that's what American policy in Iraq is about now. First of all, we demanded to go there. In fact, we insisted on going there. In fact, we went there without invitation from anyone, not the Iraqis, not the United Nations. And now we want to leave and blame them for the hell disaster we're going to leave behind.
All right. Final subject is Iran.
I feared as much. Yes, that's right.
And we haven't spoken since the... election there. The politically correct wisdom in the U.S. is that the election was stolen by the current president. What's your take on that election?
And look, I was in Iran for the elections, and I watched the massive suppression of the political opposition of Mohsen Mousavi and his supporters. I was present and walked 12 miles through Tehran with a million and a quarter strong crowds of opponents of that victory, so-called, quote-unquote, of Ahmadinejad. In fact, at the press conference, I was invited by the Iranian authorities to speak very early on if I had any question for the newly elected, quote, president, unquote, Ahmadinejad. So I made a point of calling him Mr. Ahmadinejad, sir, because I was a bit worried about the president bit. You know, was he really elected? My own suspicions, and I went round the polling booth the day before, and the Iranians thought it was going to be a fair election. They turned up in their hundreds of thousands in Tehran. My own suspicion is that Ahmadinejad may actually have won the election, but that the authorities wanted to over-egg his victory and humiliate his opponents by tampering with the figures, and thus gave him a victory which was totally incredible. I mean, incredible, but incredible. And gave a defeat to his opponents which was more humiliating than it could possibly have been. Thus giving them the opportunity, quite rightfully picked up by them, to say this was a fraud. I don't believe Ahmadinejad is legitimately in the bounds of Iranian democracy, as such a conception exists, the president of Iran, but he has been legally claimed to be and said to be and accepted to be by the judicial authorities, so I guess we've got to call him President Ahmadinejad. But he has a problem, apart from the fact that he's a crackpot, which I've said all along, not just for his, you know, denial of the Jewish Holocaust. I'm sure he'd deny the Armenian Holocaust if he had good relations with Turkey. I rather suspect he will quite soon, because he does have good relations with Turkey. But because Ahmadinejad represents a very basic, largely uneducated people, that doesn't mean they're not worthy of casting a vote. It means that those people were not properly apprised of what Ahmadinejad represented, either economically or politically or socially. I understand that before the election, poor old Barack Obama, you know, the cartoons just do him so much damage. He really thought, you know, we can have conversations with them. And actually, those conversations are taking place, as we know. And the Islamic Republic is not actually run by, you know, nitwits like our friend Mr. Ahmadinejad. It's run by more serious people. And I think that what Obama's trying to do in Iran is right. But given the behavior of the regime, both over the election and over nuclear facilities, and given the almost equally crackpot policies of the Israeli government towards Iran, it's a very dangerous situation. Because, you know, the Iranians keep saying, if we're attacked by Israel, we will strike at the heart of Israel. Well, I don't believe it. If the Iranians strike at the heart of Israel, they're going to destroy tens of thousands of Palestinians. What I'm told by sources I have, whom I believe in, but are not always correct, but usually correct, let me make this, imprimatur clear there, is that if Israel attacks Iran, Iran will attack the Americans in Iraq, they will attack the Americans in Afghanistan, in other words, on both sides of their west-east frontiers, and on their ships in the Gulf and in the Arabian Peninsula, and leave Israel alone, thus leaving Americans with the understanding that if Israel attacks a Muslim country, that Muslim country will take its retaliation against the United States of America. Now that, and remember that the Iranians, I hate to say it, understand us Westerners much better than we understand them, unfortunately for us.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein, and this is your daily investigative news magazine. Next up, a weekly edition of Community Business with Catherine Austin Fitz. So we go from Fisk to Fitz. Those of you who have been listening to my multi-year dialogue with Catherine know that for some time she has been talking about what she calls, and I believe coined the phrase, a financial coup d'etat in the government in collaboration with Wall Street and the Fed. Catherine's analysis was most recently portrayed in the recent film by Michael Moore, Capitalism, A Love Story, when Moore asks Ohio Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur if what happened with the Wall Street meltdown was, in fact, a financial coup d'etat. And Kaptur said, and I quote, "I could agree with that because the people here really aren't in charge. Wall Street is in charge." Joining us to talk about the financial coup d'etat is Catherine Austin Fitz, a regular weekly translator from Wall Street to Main Street and every direction thereof. Catherine, welcome back.
Hey, Dennis. Isn't Congressman Kaptur great?
She is extraordinary. She has made two amazing appearances. Three, let's say.
Uh-huh.
One in the Michael Moore film, two recently on Bill Moyers, where he goes over this in depth.
Great job by Bill Moyers.
Incredible. And people should read that transcript. And they should read about her encounter. And we're going to talk about that with the head of, she's actually confronting, I guess, is he the CEO?
It's the chairman CEO of J.P. Morgan Chase, Jamie Dimon.
And she ends up in a meeting with him, and she's sort of questioning him about why his people refuse to in any way deal to help people save their mortgages and that foreclosure, save their houses, and that foreclosure is up 90 or 95 or 96% in the communities that she represents around, in and around Toledo, Ohio. And let me, before I let you comment on this, and I think it's so crucial, I want
to... you ought to read it. It's fabulous.
I want to read what she says on the House floor, which ends up in Bill Moyer, on Bill Moyer's show, and also in the Michael Moore film. And she says, and this is in response to people losing their houses through foreclosure. Moyer's sort of introduces it by saying, "Congresswoman, you encourage people to break the law. You have a different view." But this is what she said on the floor. "So why should any American citizen be kicked out of their homes in this cold weather? In Ohio, it's going to be 10 or 20 below zero. Don't leave your home because you know what? When those companies say they have your mortgage, unless you have a lawyer that can put his or her finger on that mortgage, you don't have that mortgage, and you're going to find that they can't find the paper up there on Wall Street. So I say to the American people, you be squatters in your own homes. Don't you leave. In Ohio and in Michigan and Indiana and Illinois and all these other places, our people are being treated like chattel, and this Congress is stymied." I mean, so what do you say about, are they breaking the law? What do you,
in my opinion,
response?
No.
What's your response to that statement?
If we had a complete, if we brought complete transparency to what has transpired over the last 15 years, I think, Dennis, it's quite clear that the government and possibly government contractors and the banks are guilty of multiple civil and criminal, actions. And as a result, if you go through all the law, the vast majority of Americans, if they squat in their own home, are not outside the law. In fact, you know, the other parties are. So let me give you an example, because there are literally 20 different ways I think that these mortgages were falsely originated in service. But I've often said that we knew in the mid-90s that the jobs were being moved abroad. It was intentionally designed and planned at the highest levels of Wall Street and Washington, and we knew incomes were going to drop. And so when people were encouraged to take on this debt, it was by institutions who had foreknowledge that people who thought they could afford these mortgages couldn't. And so literally, under the law, that's called fraudulent inducement. And when I lend you money when I know something about your inability to pay it back in the future that you don't know, and I don't disclose that, that's a material omission, and that could be deemed a fraudulent inducement. And under those circumstances, you may not owe me the money back. And so it has not yet been litigated whether this was fraudulent inducement. In my opinion, it clearly was, and there's a real issue of, whether or not the American people owe back. A lot of borrowers owe this money. That's number one. Number two, if you look at the predatory tactics that were used to engineer a lot of this debt, market a lot of this debt, they're clear violations of all sorts of different laws and practices. In addition, you have the same parties who are engaging in the fraudulent origination of the mortgages, engaging in all sorts of securities fraud that is going to impact pension funds and investors who, when they lose all the money, it's going to bring the economy down and affect my income. So that's another way they're engaging in clearly in what I believe was security fraud that could impact our pension funds directly, or it could just impact the capital that ultimately flows into our place. And then finally, these are the same players who were responsible for all the money missing from the federal government. So you have the same banks and the same governmental lines at Treasury and some of the other agencies with $4 trillion missing from federal accounts. And that money belongs to the citizens, and shifting that money out in an illegal way has a dramatic impact on the general quality of the economy and therefore the level of employment. So, you and I could go on and on, because we've covered, many, many things on community business that these same players are doing that hurts all the different sides of your both your balance sheet and your income statement and your expenses. Finally, all of this behavior pumps up inflation, and so our savings and income diminishes as our expense rise. And there's been incredible drain over the last 10 years from the sort of subtle and hidden inflation that comes from playing all these games. And so, if you look at the different things that have been done that are outside the law, and then you look at it in combination, what we're talking about is a conspiracy. I'm so glad that Congresswoman, Kaptur said this is a financial coup d'etat, because if you take the various things they've done to drain your income, increase your expenses, diminish your savings, diminishing your assets, all of those together create a rigged game, which is, the individual actions are outside the law, but the combination, which has been very intentional and very planned, is absolutely, this is RICO conspiracy.
And that wraps it up for another edition of Flashpoints, which airs every weekday and is produced by Dennis Bernstein and Nora Barrows Friedman. Our contributing producer is Robert Knight, and our technical director is Eric Klein. Our Friday co-host is Francisco Herrera, Miguel Molina is our roving producer, and JR and the Block Report contribute to this program. To comment on today's program, please contact us at dbernstein@igc.org. Look us up on the web at www.flashpoints.net for our archive shows. Dozens of affiliate stations across the country broadcast Flashpoints on a regular basis. Please email us your call letters and Flashpoints broadcast schedule at dbernstein@igc.org, and we'll add you to our website. Many thanks to our web team, and thank you for listening.